Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kudelska. It's been a busy wildfire season, and we'll hear how fire departments are coping with less volunteers in the state.
You know, I'd like to see as much participation as we possibly can get.
A nonprofit that fills in the gaps for the largest national forest in Wyoming is preparing to play a bigger role going forward.
Be aware that the Forest Service is about to get its knees cut out from under it financially.
Last winter, the corporation that owns the Pinedale Roundup laid off all of its employees except one. Then major news hit.
I went to that protest with a gun on my hip, a knife in my pocket.
And the Road to Cheyenne series is back to prepare Wyomingites for the general election. Those stories and more on Open Spaces. Stay with us.
As we greet autumn, we're reminded of how lucky we are to season through life's transformations. Leaves turn, times change, but Wyoming Public Radio is your companion through it all. On your morning commute, your coffee break, and even those late nights. If it's been a while, consider a contribution of support. Call us during our pledge drive this October, or donate now at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Sometimes the news can be a little hard, but Around Wyoming is here to bring you the lighter side of things. Ever heard of frozen chicken curling? Or do you know how many of our residents compete in and win national competitions? Hint, it's a lot. Around Wyoming brings you that and more four times every weekday. You can also find Around Wyoming on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kudelska. Coal has played a significant role in the United Kingdom and British identity, really, since the Industrial Revolution. Coal first generated electricity in the country in the 1880s. It was the country's largest bulk export until 1939. Even the word smog was coined in London for the hazy skyline coal power created. But now, the UK is the world's first major economy to quit coal power, beating a climate-focused deadline the government set back in 2015. Tammy Saint-Yu is the British Consul General for the Northwest United States, and I was interested to have her compare how the UK is navigating its energy transition with Wyoming, the US's top coal producer. Saint-Yu started by explaining what's taking coal's place.
Up until 12 years ago, so 2012, coal was still producing 40% of our electricity. And so what we are moving towards heavily in the UK is an energy mix, but energy that is powered by clean energy, by homegrown clean energy. So our solar and wind generated electricity is coming from the UK itself. And that's supported by high quality green jobs.
So the phase-out plan was made about a decade ago. So logistically, that's not a lot of time. You guys did it, but how? And how could that possibly be a model for other countries?
Actually, the critical piece that allowed us to do this so quickly was to make the economic arguments and make it economically inviable for coal and economically viable for renewables to take off. So, you know, to meet all of that demand for electricity, we had to access the natural gas that we had in the North Sea. We had to develop our wind power. We had to develop our nuclear power. But the other bit of this, and I think it really speaks to the kind of environmental quality and arguments, is that we had to price the negative externalities from coal. And by that, I mean, you know, we had to put a price on air pollution and on carbon production. So the science tells us that coal produces more carbon than any other energy source. So as far as we in the UK are concerned, we had to phase out coal first and we had to phase it out fastest. So we mandated that coal plants needed to capture and store that carbon, but we also set a tax, a carbon tax. So that made the price of carbon more expensive and now economically inviable. And by incentivizing the renewable sector, that push down the price of renewables.
Let's now turn to potential parallels to Wyoming. We reached out to folks following Wyoming's energy transition closely. So I'm going to start off by playing a question for you here from Rob Godby. He's an economics professor at the University of Wyoming.
Based on current policy and market trends, the United States expects to phase out coal and electricity generation in the next 20 years. In Wyoming, this is a major challenge since we produce over 40% of the country's coal. The UK will have phased out all coal and electricity generation by this October. I wondered what advice you could give Wyoming policymakers as they plan for the future challenges and opportunities this change represents, based on your country's experience.
Yeah, so, I mean, look, it's a really good question, and there's no doubt that Wyoming has a really long history with coal power, just as we have had in the UK, and it has a really significant economic impact on the state. And I was really lucky to be able to visit Wyoming this summer and to meet with Governor Gordon. I think what was really interesting about that is that the governor's approach to this, and to a large extent, our approach, is what he terms an all-of-the-above approach to energy. Wyoming is already heading in the right direction. You have a natrium reactor on the site of a retiring coal facility. The big energy wind energy project at Chokecherry in Sierra Madre will be the largest wind farm once it completes. So I think continuing investments into those renewable energies, investments into transition and into the grid infrastructure, because that's what allows renewable energy to come online. But also thinking about, the fact that as you do this, that will attract other economies to the state of Wyoming. So, you know, as you put more renewable power online, data centers, for example, that are moving into Wyoming all the time, will find Wyoming a more attractive place to invest. So it will be a virtuous circle. You just have to sort of reach that tipping point. But I think the need for cheap, clean energy in Wyoming will only grow.
Okay, great. And then we have one more question from Matt Burgess. He's an economics professor at the University of Wyoming.
How is your government ensuring that such communities aren't being left behind as you transition off of coal in the UK?
A really important question. You know, I think there's lots to learn from what the UK got wrong with coal. But I think what we've learned from that is that you have to bring in your communities. You have to think about the transition of skills and of jobs. And I think one of the benefits of renewables is that lots of those jobs are transferable. The skills are transferable. We've had some successful transition stories where decommissioned coal plants are now supporting large battery units, for example. And those jobs have been able to be transferred. So it's not simply that a power plant shuts, it's that something else is created in its place, and that the people that are most impacted are part of that decision-making process, but also then are offered opportunities. So I think it's about, you know, making sure that the benefits of any transition, so transitioning from a coal-powered economy to a renewable-powered economy, doesn't leave anyone behind.
So I think this is probably very similar to the UK. You know, many coal miners come from generations of miners, and there's like a sense of pride of being a coal miner. Do you think there's a grieving process for these kind of families, or even entire towns, or do you think there will be like cultural traditions, stories, skills that might be lost with ending this industry? And how do you deal with that?
Certainly when we saw mine closures in the UK in the 1980s, and you know, some of your listeners will be aware of the major strikes that we saw in the 80s, those communities became really impoverished. I think that sense of community is really important. I think that's why it comes back to the just transition of, but also like making sure you preserve that deep history. Part of the coverage that you see in the UK is all about the history of coal. You know, talking to the people that were integral to that industry, looking at those cities and how we can kind of bring them up, how we can invest in those areas. So, yeah, I think it's extremely important.
That was British Council General Tammy Sandhu speaking about the UK's transition off coal. This year's fire season is dragging on longer than usual, and firefighters are battling these blazes with less people. It's the result of a drop nationwide in volunteerism services, and that trend is affecting Wyoming engines and ladders too. Now, fire departments are asking themselves how to build back numbers for a vital community service. Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger reports.
Jumpers airborne in 1 minute.
So Jumpers, this is the Wings of Blue. These are the parachute guys.
Firefighters like Paul Creeks have been battling wildfire after wildfire this summer. But back in July, Creeks' job as Laramie County Fire Authority Division Chief was to help out at Wings Over Warren Air Show in Cheyenne.
Today we've got a combination of paid staff working, resident students working, and volunteer members to staff a truck during our air show to help our neighboring community and partners. And that's just, it's just fun to see.
Months prior to the air show, Craig Heelig invited me to ride along with his engine for the day and talk about volunteer recruitment.
Statewide, we've seen a decrease of volunteer firefighters.
Someone will still show up when you call, but the problem is big enough that lawmakers passed multiple laws addressing the situation directly.
The Wyoming State Rural Fire Association, along with State Forestry and a lot of the other partners, were able to get some bills passed to help mitigate that a little bit and get us some more volunteers.
Those bills provided volunteer firefighters with benefits like access to the state health care plan, time off for state employees to serve as volunteer emergency personnel, and access to cancer screenings. Nick Hudson is the fire inspector for Lander. He says it's too soon to say what kind of impact these new laws will have.
Most departments that I've talked to actively been recruiting, but it's just a struggle trying to get people to come in the door. Anything that you can do to try to help incentivize that and to make it a little bit more appealing, you know, might be beneficial.
Hudson says despite volunteer numbers remaining down, fire engines are ready to go 24/7. But the time of the fire might determine how many people show up to fight it.
So you only have so many people that are going to be able to show up during the day or during regular working hours. You might have people that volunteer that work night shift. They try to show up when they're not working, but there's a lot of times when you're at work, you just can't go to a call. And so you try to up your numbers or up your roster numbers so that way you have a higher percentage to draw from at any time that the call can come in.
So fire departments, ladders, and fire districts across the state are doing what they can for recruitment. But it's a battle they're not used to.
Luke.
I hope not.
Back at the Laramie County Firehouse, some of the longer-serving crew members say there was a time when the department used to recruit for itself. Back when fire season was a little shorter, departments used to be what many called a boys' club. It was exclusive, but their numbers remained high as firefighting was seen akin to a form of public service or a brothers-in-arms case, like the military. The public service importance remains true, but the fires are now larger, the risk is higher, and volunteering doesn't pay the bills. So how are firefighters fighting this?
All right, we are live in the command post.
Well, Heelig has taken to quirky and engaging social media posts.
We just had our first call of a grass fire. Fire is out now, though.
Crick says showing up to college job fairs might help recruit volunteer and career firefighters. Hudson says he's seen departments putting out yard signs, holding cookouts, and reaching out to veterans. Jordan Zunaga, the business manager for Laramie County Fire, also has an idea to bring on new talent.
We have women in every single volunteer round that we've done since I've been here. So they are applying. They are starting to show up. They're just, you know, you'll get 15 guys for one girl. I think that, you know, in high school, kind of your like blue collar, your hands on, your more trade school stuff is pushed more to your male audience. So I think the biggest problem is it's just not made accessible or knowledgeable to women until they go out and find it themselves.
Fire departments aren't exactly sure how to overcome the dwindling volunteer numbers. They are sure that fighting fires remains a public necessity. And Paul Crick says it's never too late to get involved.
The deeper your bench is in those times of need, you know, I'd like to see as much participation as we possibly can get.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Jordan Uplinger.
Up next, another industry in the state is struggling with fewer staff, but for a different reason: consolidations. This is Open Spaces.
Wyoming Public Media is providing Wyoming and Western wildfire updates on air and now online. Go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Wyoming Wildfire Info. You'll find links to the latest updates on fires around the region, along with information on current air quality conditions, fire restrictions, information on protecting your property, and more. Find it all in one place at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Sometimes the world is not as small as they say. The truth is, it is a big world out there with so much happening, and it can get overwhelming. Sometimes you can only focus on the things in front of you. Wyoming Public Radio proudly provides important world news. However, we also provide the news and stories from your Wyoming hometown. Keep it local. Donate at wyomingpublicmedia.org. And thank you.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Over the last 20 years, local news has seen massive consolidations as small town papers lost advertisers and were forced to sell to large corporations. Since then, 57% of newsroom staff have been laid off in the U.S. This trend can create what's called a ghost paper.
It's still printing. It still has words and some pictures, but it is cut way back on local reporting. It barely covers the community anymore. It's filling the pages with national stories and wire services.
In Wyoming, three large corporations own over half the local newspapers, including all the largest circulations. But what happens when major news hits? Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports from Sublette County.
Back in April, Sublette County made international headlines when a man brought a wolf into a local bar, muzzled and injured. He'd run over it with a snowmobile and later killed it. Pinedale Roundup editor Callie O'Hare says she should have broken that story. Since then, she's made up for lost time.
We've covered it in great detail, and I've been boots on the ground for that.
But why wasn't she the one to break it? Well, that's because last winter, her publisher, News Media Corporation, laid off both of her reporters. The company didn't respond to numerous requests by Wyoming Public Media for comment. Since then, O'Hare's been running the 120-year-old weekly newspaper by herself.
I sure would have loved to have had a staff working on other stuff because that took so much away from me.
With a story with this much attention on it, she really wishes she'd had an editor.
It does make me nervous not having another set of eyes reading over my stuff. So I tend to read over it until I'm cross-eyed.
She's also had to face the pushback from the reporting all alone.
The county treasurer asked me to stop the coverage of the wolf. An employee for the Road and Bridge Department, Robert Binning, was saying that I'm a bitch on a witch hunt for a man's family.
What happened at this bar?
When a motorcycle rally came to town in late May to protest the wolf torture, protesters clashed with locals. She says they revved their engines to drown out her interviews. With her camera and microphone, she felt like a target.
I went to that protest with a gun on my hip, a knife in my pocket.
When local news contracts, it creates a vacuum.
That's Steve Waldman, the president of the media advocacy group Rebuild Local News.
The vacuum is filled by national media and social media. National media tends to be more partisan, so the contraction of local news leads to more polarization, more people demonizing each other.
Waldman says numerous studies show real harm to communities from the collapse of local news, especially rural ones.
Direct effects are things like literally people don't have the information they need to decide who to vote for or to know what's going on at their school or to hold the government accountable.
His organization supports a bill introduced in Congress that would incentivize businesses to put ads in local papers to give them a more reliable funding stream.
It's really clever. It's like, so the tax credit literally goes to restaurants and hardware stores and car dealerships if they advertise in local newspapers or radio.
And the bill would give a payroll tax credit to newspapers to hire more local reporters. Waldman says the bill is very bipartisan and that Representative Harriet Hageman and the state senators should support it. Today, O'Hare is facing a very busy morning.
I've got 4 pages left that I'm working on building before our deadline here. And then at 10, I have some of the folks from the Little League coming over because, of course, now I'm a sports reporter, too.
And that's not all that she does.
So I do all the social media management. I do all the website management. I pay the bills to keep the lights on and the rent, the gas, the trash.
Janitor, answer phones. Reporter, yeah. Editor.
Yeah, photographer.
And she does all of that for a mere $41,000 a year. Truth is, though, lots of rural papers are going through the same thing. News Media Corporation owns over 150 publications in 5 states, 16 of them just in Wyoming.
Hey! Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
The Pinedale Little League coach arrives for his interview. O'Hare says it's the little stories like this one that keep communities united. And that means the Pinedale Roundup won't become a ghost paper anytime soon. From Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
The U.S. Forest Service is likely facing hundreds of millions of dollars in budget cuts from Congress and a suspension on seasonal hiring, which is thousands of jobs. That's a hard pill to swallow, especially for the Bridger Teton in western Wyoming. It's the third largest U.S. forest in the lower 48, and it's already had a tough time keeping up with demands like clearing trails. About 5 years ago, the Bridger Teton turned to a nonprofit for help, a relatively novel concept in the forest world. As Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan reports, it could be a key model for forests going forward.
Scott Kosiba is in his office in downtown Pinedale. He's on a Zoom call for All Trails staff. It's the app used by hikers.
Yeah, can I jump in one more time really quick?
All Trails is working with forests for mapping trails. Notably, no one from the Bridger Teton is on the call. They don't have to be, because Kosiba is there. He heads up Friends of the Bridger Teton. It's essentially the nonprofit arm of the forest. And today, Kosiba is getting everyone on the same page.
Be aware that the Forest Service is about to get its knees cut out from under it financially.
So that's where Kosiba and his nonprofit steps in. After his Zoom call, Kosiba explains,
we're able to do collectively far more than the agency is able to do, both because of funding constraints, capacity on their staff,
and bureaucratic limitations. There are very specific rules for how taxpayer money is used, but it's not always cost effective. Take, for example, the smelly business of pumping public toilets.
It's going to be loud.
Okay.
So you're aware.
Okay. That's Rhett Jones's job. He's at a Bridger Teton campground toilet just north of Pinedale.
A lot of trash bags get thrown in here, loaded with stuff. Bottles, cans, chew cans.
Jones siphons about 2,000 pounds of waste into his truck's tank. It's part of an annual process.
It's not a sexy part of keeping access for the public, but it is so, so important.
Kosiba is also here today because this is one of the nonprofit's biggest wins. A little over a year ago, these toilets were almost locked. The federal government had contracted a larger Boise company to do multiple forests in the region, which was cheaper as a whole, but not for the Bridger Teton. The Boise company didn't have permission to dump waste in towns like Pinedale or Jackson, so that meant pumping one or two toilets and driving back to Boise to dump, and so on and so forth for 62 toilets.
This was absolutely a crisis situation.
The total cost was $80,000 from the Bridger Tetons recreation budget, which Kosiba says would have bankrupted it.
We're talking no trails cleared, we're talking no, you know, campground hosts.
The forest's hands were bureaucratically tied, so the nonprofit stepped in. They kept the contract with Rhett Jones's company, which is allowed to dump locally, and it cost about a third less. The toilets stayed open and clean, which Jones shows off today.
These old fly nests that were in the corners, we've knocked them out, spray them down, get your window sills, everything.
Wow, I've never smelled such a nice porta potty. Wow.
And it's not just toilets. There's a never-ending list for keeping up 3.4 million acres of forest.
It exceeds our capacity pretty quickly.
Mary Cernicek is with the Bridger Teton. She says the nonprofit has also helped with fundraising, which a federal agency can't do. And the nonprofit manages a lot of volunteers who can help clear trails and put out abandoned campfires.
We're no longer just the Bridger Teton National Forest trying to go at it alone.
Cernicek says the nonprofit is the forest's one constant. She's tight-lipped about looming budget cuts, but she says Kosiba's group will be key for keeping the forest going.
It is astounding that a nonprofit has to exist to help fund and help support a federal land management agency.
And neither Kosiba nor the forest see that ending soon. But to keep it up, Kosiba says Friends of the Bridger Teton will need to grow from its relatively meager $1.5 million budget. Meanwhile, D.C. lawmakers have until December 20th to hash out a budget, leaving the forest in limbo. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan on the Bridger Teton in Pinedale.
Up next, our series previewing the elections is back. This is Open Spaces.
Sustaining members provide reliable support for the programs you count on. When you become a sustaining member, your donation will renew year after year, all saving time, money, and resources. Sustainers are crucial to providing an ongoing basis of community support that we can rely on so that you can continue to listen to Wyoming Public Radio. Become a sustaining member at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Coming up on Wyoming Sounds, it's New Music Wednesday with me, Melanie Nielsen. Join me for new music from Cowboy Ross Cooper, The Fratellis in Babe Rainbow, Fruit Bats, Corp Lund, and this one from Galen McKinney from the McKinney Zone. Tune in 9 to noon for Wyoming Sounds on Wyoming Public Radio.
This is Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. With the general election about a month away, we're back with The Road to Cheyenne, our special series about the elections. This week, we're taking a step back and we'll look at where Wyoming politics stands after the primary. Plus, we'll take a look at a House race that captured much of the division we've been seeing within the state Republican Party. So with me to parse this out is Wyoming Public Radio's State House reporter Chris Clements and special guest Wildfile freelancer reporter Maya Shimizu Harris. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
Okay, so let's start with you, Chris. Primary election night was a good one for the Freedom Caucus and not a great one for several longtime incumbents. Chris, can you give us a quick recap of the gains by the Freedom Caucus?
Sure thing. So just really quickly, right now, we can confirm a total of 26 Freedom Caucus endorsed and aligned for sure wins. The Freedom Caucus could gain 6 or 7 more seats if all their candidates who are facing contested general elections all win. They could win a majority in the House, and that would, you know, obviously give them a lot more leeway and power to decide what legislation comes up.
Okay, so to gain some of these seats, there were a couple of upsets in the primary where Freedom Caucus endorsed candidate pushed an incumbent out. What does that mean for the next session?
We've heard from a few different lawmakers that there will be definitely a loss of institutional knowledge of how the House operates after the election. Representative Dan Zwanitzer in Cheyenne talked to us about that after he learned he'd lost to a Freedom Caucus-endorsed candidate.
This is the new normal in Wyoming. You know, we knocked off probably 75% of the leaders in the House, the people who'd been there multiple terms, decades, if not a century of institutional knowledge, will be taken out this year.
Another big upset that shocked folks was Speaker of the House Albert Summers' loss against Laura Pearson, another Freedom Caucus candidate.
I do have concerns, but ultimately, we will see how they lead, right? That remains to be seen. They haven't been in power before, so you can't say for sure how they will govern, but time will tell.
I guess Summers' point being that governing can be a lot different than being in the minority. What did Freedom Caucus members say about that?
Yeah, so I spoke with Representative John Baer, the former chair of the Freedom Caucus, and he told me this is the right direction.
Almost a century of incumbency removed in this election alone, and I think that is monumental and probably worthy of a headline of its own.
Quickly, before we turn to Maya to talk about a race that bucked this trend, I do want to point out that the primary had a very low voter turnout, actually the lowest since 2016. The Secretary of State's official results show 122,700 votes cast this year in the primary, and that was down about 60,000 from the 22 primary, which had about 182,200 votes cast.
That's a really good point to make, Camila, but let's not forget that since the primary, more than 10,000 Wyomingites have registered to vote.
Okay, so Maya, you spent months focused on one race, which showcased a Freedom Caucus incumbent and a more moderate Republican challenger. This is House District 57, which represents parts of Casper. Why did you want to do this story and how did it come about?
Yeah, well, before the primaries, we knew that the main question of this election cycle for Wyoming would be whether or not the hardline Republicans aligned with the Wyoming Freedom Caucus would manage to take a majority in the legislature. And people have described this tension between the Wyoming Freedom Caucus and more traditional or moderate Republicans as a battle for the soul or spirit of Wyoming and for the meaning of conservatism. So we were interested in the House District 57 race because Jeanette Ward, who was the Republican incumbent and a member of the Wyoming Freedom Caucus, really stands out as a representative of this hardline conservative movement. And then Julie Jarvis, the Republican who challenged her and ultimately beat Ward in the primaries, is a Natrona County School District Administrator. Ward has been really active in local school board meetings, so Jarvis got to see the lawmakers' evolution kind of up close.
Okay, and I want to ask about Ward and Jarvis's backgrounds, but first, help me picture these two women. Tell me about the Central Wyoming Fair Parade in Casper.
Yeah, so in election years, you'll see a lot of candidates in this parade with their campaign signs and such. And this year, Ward was marching with some other legislative candidates who are aligned with the Freedom Caucus. They were carrying American flags and walking in front of this big military-style truck. Ward's campaign sign had a GOP elephant that looked like it was about to charge something, and it really reminded me of something that John Baer, the former chairman of the Freedom Caucus, had once said. He said that he envisioned the caucus being a military unit that's ready to fight and stand in the gap for the people of Wyoming. So Ward and the other candidates with her really embodied that. Jarvis, on the other hand, had this small trailer that her two kids and their friends had decorated with streamers. They had water guns. They were wearing Mardi Gras beads. Her float was playing songs by Miley Cyrus and other music of that genre. It was a really kind of small town atmosphere.
Wow, that's a big contrast. So who are they? What are their values and policy goals?
So Ward is from Illinois. She moved to Casper less than a year before she ran for this position. And many people commented to me about how tenacious and disciplined she is, both personally and as a politician. So she's very well educated. She's a CrossFitter, which many people mentioned to me. She had served on a school board in Illinois, and she also unsuccessfully ran for a Senate seat in that state. So she already had some political experience by the time she became a lawmaker here. So Jarvis was born in Wyoming, and she grew up on a small farm outside of Buffalo. She really emphasized her background as a fourth generation Wyomingite during her campaign, which stood in contrast towards background as a newcomer to the state. She's also very well educated and went to school in Connecticut for some time before coming back to Wyoming and settling here. And unlike Ward coming into the campaign, Jarvis didn't have any political experience.
Okay, pretty different. So what did the race end up looking like? What happened?
So Jarvis, the challenger, chose to run a pretty unique campaign. Instead of presenting a policy platform that stemmed from her own views, she decided to develop a survey that asked constituents in her district what they thought about a variety of policy issues. And she promised to vote according to the preferences that people show through that survey.
I have found that when you set a goal and allow for people around you to create and define how to get there, amazing things happen. Therefore, my political platform is designed to do just that. It is centered around giving the voice back to the local people.
Interesting. And what did voters think about that approach?
A lot of the voters in her district who I talked to said they liked it. Others said they didn't feel that a survey with, you know, a limited number of questions would really capture enough information to inform Jarvis on the hundreds of bills that the legislature considers each year. So we'll see how that goes when the ideas actually apply to real legislation and policy decisions. On the other hand, Ward, being the incumbent, was able to campaign on her voting record.
So last election cycle, I promised voters that I was pro-life, pro-freedom, pro-Second Amendment, and pro-family. And that's exactly how I voted.
She emphasized her endorsements by conservative organizations like Wyoming Right to Life and Gun Owners of America. Her campaigning against Jarvis was pretty aggressive, and some of it was classic Freedom Caucus. She accused Jarvis of being a rhino.
That's Republican in name only.
Right, and similarly, the Wyoming Freedom Caucus's Political Action Committee also sent out mailers accusing Jarvis of being a liberal. And Ward also targeted Jarvis in her professional capacity as a school district administrator.
Okay, the trend of the primary was Freedom Caucus candidates energizing enough voters to come out that they toppled incumbents. But here, it was actually a newcomer took down a well-established Freedom Caucus member. How did Jarvis win?
Jarvis got a much earlier start than the Republican candidate who opposed Ward in the last election cycle. So her campaign had time to do a lot of door knocking, to send out mailers, to push out advertisements, and to raise funds. And on the subject of funds, Jarvis's campaign actually raised more than double the amount that Ward's did. So her campaign had more resources to draw on. And people also said that Ward's aggressive messaging in her mailers was actually off-putting and made them less enthusiastic about her as a candidate.
Got it. And let's take a step back like you did. The second part of the series is taking a look at how the Wyoming Freedom Caucus rose to power in the last couple of years. Two things stood out to me. Let's start with the Wyoming Freedom Caucus's partnership with the national organization.
Yeah, so the Wyoming Freedom Caucus is partnered with the State Freedom Caucus Network, which is a DC-based organization that's trying to establish freedom caucuses in every state across the country. And so far, the network has done that in a dozen states. So some members of the Wyoming Freedom Caucus told me that they were initially hesitant about partnering with any organization coming out of DC. But those who ended up supporting the partnership said that they see the network as a useful resource, and they don't see it as an organization that's going to tell them what to do and how to vote, as critics of this partnership say. So the national network pays the salary of a state director for every Freedom Caucus, and in Wyoming, that state director is Jessie Rubino. She was born and raised in Wyoming. She's the spouse of Joe Rubino, the Secretary of State's chief policy officer, and the nephew of Wyoming's U.S. Representative, Harriet Higman. So Jesse Rubino researches bills and provides analysis and vote recommendations for members of the Freedom Caucus and others who sympathize with the caucus.
Okay, so maybe it's not as influenced from the top down as some criticize, but still not entirely Wyoming grown. The second thing that stood out to me was the potential future of the caucus. As we've discussed, the caucus is posed to gain a majority after the general session. What do they hope to do with this majority?
Well, first of all, if they gain a majority, they'll be able to put more of their people in leadership positions in the legislature. That'll give them a lot more authority to direct the body and focus on the policy issues that the caucus most cares about. Looking further into the future, the Wyoming Freedom Caucus wants to try to put more allies into the executive branch as well. And most importantly, they want to do that in the office of the governor. That position is especially important because the governor holds veto power. In fact, Governor Gordon has in the past vetoed legislation that the Freedom Caucus championed. So this is a significant obstacle right now for the Freedom Caucus's goals.
Well, Maya, thank you so much for describing the story that you worked on. And thanks, Chris, for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Camila.
All right, well, we'll be back on October 25th to look at the races that will determine the control of the state house in the general. Stay with us as we learn about grizzly human cohabitation and a unique piece of music composed just for the harp. This is Open Spaces.
Want to keep up with local news but can't have your radio on 24/7? That's where Wyoming Public Radio's email newsletters come in. Get all of the local and regional news you want in your inbox. You can choose if you want an update every day or a weekly roundup of our top stories, or both. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
The Modern West podcast is resharing our ranching series, The Great Individualist. This time, we explore our deep, abiding love for the cowboy.
If you go out there and bust your butt out there taking care of cows and or even putting up the hay, it's so rewarding. I can get on the saddle horse and ride all day.
The Rolling Stone. It's episode 2. Find The Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. There's been some high-profile grizzly bear run-ins in the state this summer. In late September, an archery hunter was attacked by a bear in the upper Green River Basin and ultimately killed it with a handgun. A new book titled Grizzly Confidential explores how grizzlies and humans can live together and hopefully decrease the amount of conflicts, especially in landscapes where their worlds are increasingly overlapping. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman talked with Jackson-based author and paramedic Kevin Grange about management strategies, endangered species status, and what it actually looks like to respect the bear.
I've always been fascinated with grizzly bears, but when 399 took her four cubs on a walkabout around Jackson Hole, I was conflicted. You know, I thought I loved bears and I was a bear person, but now they were inconveniencing me where I mountain bike, you know, where I hike, where I trail run. So my love of them was tested, and I realized I needed to know more about them. So I embarked on this journey just to learn everything I could about them, see if I could understand grizzly bears, and answer the important question of how can we coexist.
Your book is full of interviews and conversations with grizzly bear experts from around the world. What are a few especially juicy grizzly bear facts you learned while working on this project?
When most people think about brown bears, they only see their size and their strength, but I'm really fascinated with their hibernation physiology, that they can gain all this weight and not get diabetes, heart disease, and they can slow their heart rate to 8 to 10 beats per minute, yet their blood doesn't clot, so they don't get strokes. And so what this might mean for the medical community and for saving human lives, I think is really fascinating.
Given that Wyoming's grizzly population is growing, are people learning to live with bears here?
I think we are over time, and I think the new normal should be, you know, whether you're hiking, camping, fishing, is just to expect bears and just kind of have it preset in your mind and with those you're with what to do, you know, when you see a bear, and just sort of the best practices of staying safe in bear country.
Yeah, on that topic, it seems like there have been more cases of grizzlies in unexpected places. For example, one was spotted earlier this spring outside the Bighorns, which has historically not really been grizzly bear territory. That bear was ultimately euthanized after attacking cattle in the area. So how do you think people and land managers can adapt to grizzlies that are on the move?
I think it needs to be a community solution, and we all have to work together to support having grizzlies on the landscape. So if a grizzly bear is, you know, near a ranch and does, say, attack a cow, you know, as a community, we can reimburse that rancher with, you know, a carcass reimbursement program. We can maybe help pay for the electrified fence. And then as a community, just working together to secure our garbage, compost, bird feeders, beehives. And it really does have to be a thousand small little actions versus one big action. Because if attractants are secured at my house and my neighbor across the street isn't doing it, then it's not going to really work. The bear is just going to cross the street and get into that food source.
Thinking about a topic that's been pretty hot recently, some officials in Montana and Wyoming say grizzlies should be taken off the endangered species list. Based on your research while writing this book, do you think a delisting would help or hurt human and bear relationships in the area?
It's a very complex question, and to be honest, I think it's double-sided. You know, in some ways, if you delist it, there's a certain segment of the population that will become more tolerant of having bears on the landscape for one reason or another. But then on the other side, the bears in the lower 48, they're always food stress. They're often displaced by humans and our roads and whatnot. It's not really a huge population, so I can certainly see the reason not to delist them.
Staying in that vein, Montana and Wyoming have been working together to move bears from one ecosystem to another in the hopes of increasing genetic diversity and also getting the species delisted. Do you think this sort of artificial migration could succeed?
I think it's a good start, and it raises awareness that we need to connect these ecosystems. Ultimately, I think it's a band-aid, and I think we need to have natural corridors, you know, connected habitats, whether it's building a wildlife corridor or bridge. But to me, that's sort of like the one question that a lot of people aren't really asking. When you look at a map of like the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, it's just surrounded by roads. And so I feel, to me, one of the biggest detriment of brown bears thriving and surviving in this area is just getting those landscapes connected. So it's dealing with the roads, whether it's logging roads, whether it's highways, and just giving them a way to find that safe passage between, say, Glacier and Yellowstone.
You return to this phrase, respect the bear and the bear will respect you, throughout the book. For you, what does that respect look like?
To me, the phrase sounded so simple when I first heard it, but then kind of like a Zen cone. It just got really deep and cyclical and complex. But ultimately, what it came to me to mean for me was, if you respect the bear, you'll make an effort to learn about it. Once you learn about bears, you'll begin to understand them. Once you understand them, you'll act consistently and safely around them. If you do that, bears will act consistently around you, and they won't react defensively or aggressively. So it really comes full circle.
Thinking about more people moving into bear territory or more bears moving into people territory, do you have any words of wisdom or advice you would share to people who are maybe coming into this human-bear relationship for the first time?
I'd like to just let people know that coexistence with grizzly bears is possible, and it's also worthwhile. You know, the discipline that it takes to be a bear-aware community, you know, securing attractants, using the best practices when you're hiking, it's really not that hard. And so me and my wife at our house, we have, you know, we've secured our attractants, and it just feels good to not always be apex, to not always be number one, but to like share the landscape with grizzly bears and all the species that fall underneath them.
Kevin, I know it's hard to condense a 250-page book into a short conversation, so anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, I think here in the lower 48 states, there's a lot of groups that have different feelings on brown bears, and surprisingly, they all want them on the landscape. Animal rights groups, the biologists and the managers, you know, even the hunting community. So I think one way to move forward is to start with that shared goal and then work backwards. We all want grizzly bears on the landscape. So I think that's important, and I think that's the way to move forward.
I've been talking with Kevin Grange, Jackson resident and author of the new book, Grizzly Confidential. Kevin, thanks so much for making the time to talk.
Thanks so much for having me. I had a great time.
The University of Wyoming Symphony Orchestra is opening their season with a pretty unique piece on October 10th. The Harp of Ages spans the history of harp musicians. Every movement is based on a different harpist in history, and even one harpist from the future. The Harp of Ages piece is what is known as a harp concerto.
A concerto for any instrument with orchestra is where the soloist is out on the front of the stage in front of the orchestra, and the orchestra accompanies the soloist.
That's Courtney Hershey-Bress. She's the harp soloist and the principal harpist of the Colorado Symphony. I'm going to let Bress explain how she got a well-known composer to write the piece for her.
Probably about a decade ago, I approached Michael Dougherty and I called him up on the phone and I said, hey, would you be interested? And he said, sure, I've got one concerto for the harp. I will write it for you. This piece is the only harp concerto that exists. It's wild, magical, wonderful. It's also in seven movements because at the base of the harp, there are seven pedals. Each movement is extremely different. They're all based on the harp throughout time, from way back from David in the Bible all the way to, I don't know, Star Trek is what, 23rd century. He took figures or important things from over the course of time, and he used those as his inspiration for writing each movement. The first movement, which may be my favorite still to this day, because everybody always asks me, and I love Sappho Leaps. And Sappho was from around 600 BCE, and she was the first lyrical poet who also played the harp from that time period in Greece. And she bases this movement off of her rhythm of her poetry. And it's got crazy special effects. I'm playing glissandos, which is when you go all the way up and down the strings of the instrument, and I'm using my nails for a lot of those glissandos. The second movement, it's for Sister Juana Inez de la Cruz, who was a female Mexican poet, scholar, musician, and nun. And she was from the 1600s. And this one's called Sister Juana's Hymn, which it sounds like a hymn. Her song is the third one, and that is the Star Trek movement. Followed by the fourth one, which is David's Prayer. And that sounds like a prayer, but it's also, to me, the most romantic of all the movements. And then we go into the wild movement, which is my cadenza, which is Harpo Speaks, and that's based on Harpo Marx. And that's a little over 3 minutes, and it's only solo harp, and it's wild. And I do so many special effects on the instrument that some people might get scared about what I'm doing. And then after that, we go into Detroit Blues, which is just calm and bluesy. Alice Coltrane and Dorothy Ashby from Detroit. They were the jazz harpists, pioneers of jazz harp. And then we go into Irish Wedding, which is the last movement. That's the only one that's not based on a harpist. I mean, it's based on Irish music and the fact that the harp has been the symbol of Ireland for forever.
That was solo harpist Courtney Hershey Bress talking about the piece she'll be playing at the University of Wyoming Symphony Orchestra's opening night in Laramie on October 10th. The orchestra has 5 more concerts this season. Those include the Gala Holiday Concerts, the Jacoby Competition Finals in March, and a season finale in May, which showcases Mahler's Symphony No. 4. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Hannah Haberman, today's audio producer, and Ivy Engel, our digital producer. And a thank you to our social media manager, Cody Hume. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.